In the desolate landscape of Siberia, a cold winter wind whipped through the long hair of a towering samurai. At more than 6 feet tall, Danbara Kentochi struck a fearsome figure against the icy night. In his right hand, he held an eight-sided iron club. His left hand, meanwhile, gripped the mane of the great lion he was riding like a horse. Before Kentochi stood a great tower, and imprisoned inside the tower was a hero of Japanese history, Seigo Takamori, the nobleman who inspired the Tom Cruise movie The Last Samurai.
What do you want?
To know my enemy.
After he led the rebellion against the Meiji government, Takamori fled to the Philippines, and when Jui's warships came, he took up his sword once again to help Aguinaldo and the other Filipino troops fight against their new American conquerors. But the Americans caught up to the last samurai and turned him over to the Russians, who locked him up deep inside a citadel hidden in the Siberian wastes. But no more. Japan's most fearless warrior and boldest knight, Danbara Kentochi, was here to spring him loose, and together they would sail back to the Philippines and help Aguinaldo in his war against the Americans. Of course, this is all fiction. Seigo Takamori is the real-life last samurai, true, but he never went to the Philippines. In fact, just like in his fictionalized movie version, he died during his failed rebellion.
What happened to the warriors at Thermopylae?
Dead to the last man.
And as for the lion-riding, club-wielding, 6-foot samurai Danbara Kentochi? Well, he was the main character in two swashbuckling adventure novels written by Shunro Ishikawa, in which this brave hero fights against tyranny and oppression and colonization in the Philippines. The books were published in 1902 and 1906, but almost 40 years later, at the height of World War II, they continued to exert a great influence on how the Japanese thought of their new colony. Welcome to the Colonial Department, the podcast where we take long-lost stories from Philippine colonial history and bring them to life. In this episode, we take a look at one of the most extraordinary brainwashing programs of the Japanese for Filipino soldiers and how it completely and utterly failed. This is Season 3, Episode 6, From Constaboy to Samurai. With the occupation of Manila and the fall of Bataan, Japan set about the difficult task of reprogramming the Filipino mind to accept their new rulers.
Ang mga representantes ng propaganda corps ng Japanese Imperial Army ay kasalukuyang pumupunta sa mga probinsya upang tulungan ang mga Filipino.
The battleground shifted to the schools. English was struck from the curriculum, with Nihongo and Tagalog becoming the official languages. Unfortunately, most of the textbooks were written in English and packed with references to the United States, so government censors had to work overtime to cut out or paste over pictures of George Washington and Abraham Lincoln. Also dropped from the menu were humanities and social studies, any subject, basically, that had the taint of Western thought. More practical and vocational courses were introduced. Gardening, handicrafts, concepts of design, watercolor, macrame. There was also a stronger focus on math and sciences, plus, of course, subjects devoted to learning Japanese culture. Years after the war, a young man looked back on his tense, confusing days as a schoolboy. He was in grade 1 in a Binondo school when the war broke out, but was accelerated to grade 3 when school came back in mid-1942. He remembered,
I could not understand what was happening, and the usual inquisitive mind of a young boy could not be properly answered by a fearful teacher who got stressed every time I said anything nasty about the Japanese. For the first time in my life, I learned the meaning of the word hate.
Another distinctive feature of life during wartime was the Japanese version of PE. Perhaps the Japanese wanted their new subjects to be as fit and as manly as fearless samurai Danbara Kentochi. So what they did was to launch a Rajo Taiso, which translates simply as radio exercise.
皆さんの学校新聞の時間でございます。国民学校の皆様、お元気でいらっしゃいますか？
It was a nationwide group calisthenics program, with exercise instructions cheerfully piped over the airwaves and Japanese warlike music playing in the background. You had to do it every day, especially for members of the Seinendan, which was sort of like the Philippine version of the Hitler Youth. Students from that period even recalled trooping to Luneta for live calisthenic workouts, so you can imagine it as some kind of crazy wartime Zumba with rows and rows of unwilling Filipinos stretching their hands in the air or touching their toes. Curiously enough, Radyo Taiso survives to this day. The martial music may be gone, but the idea of an audio exercise program on the air was an enduring one. According to Japanese broadcaster NHK, the current version is just 3 minutes long and is still in use in offices, schools, and homes. School kids doing calisthenics weren't the only target of Japanese re-education. Okay, I'm being polite here, but let's call it what it really was: brainwashing. Surprisingly, the new occupiers were also eager to convert their prisoners of war. Imagine, after shelling them senseless in the battles of Bataan and Corregidor, after subjecting them to the brutal death march to Tarlac, after beating them, starving them, and killing their friends, Japanese officers wanted to integrate the POWs into the brand new society they were building. To help police the archipelago, the Empire set up a Bureau of Constabulary, or BC, which they wanted to staff with the soldiers that had surrendered. The prisoners felt they had no choice but to play along. One of the death march survivors, Mariano Villarin, wrote years later in his memoirs,
"Having Filipino policemen in towns was far better than having a garrison of Japanese troops who were waxing fat by living off the land, harassing a subjugated population, and molesting our women. We were resigned to the fact that, at least as USAFI veterans, we would serve as an effective buffer between the vicious occupation forces and the population."
Hundreds of former Philippine Army and Philippine Constabulary officers were drafted as Japanese-appointed constables. But their loyalty still remained strong, and now that they were inside the system, the BC men became vital spies for the resistance. When the right time came, they even deserted the constabulary, melting away into the night with their new Japanese weapons. Mariano Villarin and 9 other former prisoners of war were also selected for a program that the Japanese called quote-unquote spiritual rejuvenation. To flush out the last pro-American feeling from their system and fully convert them into the Japanese way of life, a handful of key figures were picked out to become scholars who would study in Japan. This group of scholars, hostages really, were a mixed, confused bag. There were the usual VIP suspects: the son of President Jose P. Laurel, the sons of Executive Commission Chairman Jorge Vargas, 2 aristocratic sons from Mindanao royal families. Then there was Villarin and the other so-called Consta boys. There was also a bona fide war hero, Captain Elpidio the Duke Duque, who was a member of the Philippine Scouts with a silver star to his name. And there was the fiery Benjo Osias, who was a captured guerrilla whom the Japanese thought they could sideline by shipping to Japan. They arrived in Tokyo on July 9, 1943, after a 10-day journey at sea. It was no pleasant field trip for the scholars, that's for sure. They were thrown into a tough, highly regimented schedule. They had to continuously count off interminable bango and tenko, roll calls that had to be done perfectly, or they would be forced to repeat them from the beginning. They would sprint up and down streets and fields and parade grounds to keep fit. They had to attend Buddhist and Shinto rituals all over the city. And twice a day, the Filipinos had to face the direction of the Emperor's palace and bow down to the waist to the God King of Japan. The scholars looked up to the Duke for leadership, and the war hero's instructions to the group were clear. they would resist any attempt at brainwashing, and they would gather up any intelligence they could find in Tokyo. They did that first goal rather splendidly. In the ranks of the scholars that the Japanese brought in from their wartime colonies or allies, from Burma, from Thailand, Java, the Dutch East Indies, the Filipinos got the reputation for being the most rebellious and the most hard-headed. At their Tokyo language school, Benjo Osias led the Filipinos in two strikes, refusing to go to school until the Japanese 1. Released their allowances, 2. Stopped herding them like sheep, and 3. Allowed the Muslim students to eat dawn breakfast during Ramadan. What happened next? If they had disrespected the Japanese like that back home in the Philippines, perhaps they would have been sent to prison, tortured, or even beheaded. But curiously enough, the Japanese had no home court advantage when it came to their scholars. The scholars were here as ostensibly invited guests and VIPs, and that seemed to grant them a force field against reprisals. The Japanese officers tiptoed around the constables and caved in to the demands of their strike. Soon, the other Asian student groups were staging their own strikes and mini-rebellions. Some Japanese officials were probably baffled about why the Filipinos were not embracing the empire as friends and liberators. A scholar Takamichi Serizawa noted in a 2015 paper, one of the most influential writers on Philippine-Japanese relations in the 1940s, was a big fan of the adventure novels of Shunro Oshikawa. So perhaps the Japanese imagined themselves like the samurai Dambara Kentoji, swooping into the Philippines to save their Asian brothers from the villainous Americans. So why were the Filipinos so resistant to their overtures? Come on, guys. It's not hard to imagine why. In Tokyo, the Japanese toured the constables around military installations and wartime plants, hoping to impress their new subjects with their imperial industrial flex. At night in their quarters, however, the Filipinos made maps of all the aircraft and tank factories they visited. They also openly misbehaved. They boycotted this one athletic competition, which was like some sort of sea games between the Southeast Asians and the Japanese. 3 in the group tried to go over the bakod in their dormitory, scaling the walls to find refuge in the Philippine embassy. One of them even beat up an uppity Japanese officer after the Filipino scholar was caught smoking. But there was one instance that rebellion was met with fatal consequences. One scholar pretended to go insane so that he would be sent back home to the Philippines. This time, however, the Japanese weren't having it. Hil Balais was asked to leave the dormitory, and then, a few days later, his ashes and his luggage were turned over to the Philippine embassy. The official report said that he had died in a plane crash. He was the only Filipino hostage in Japan listed as a wartime casualty. At one point in their trip, Mariano Villarin and 9 other scholars met up with General Masaharu Homma. What a fateful meeting this was. On one side were 10 survivors of Bataan and Corregidor and the horrors of the Death March. On the other side was the man who would come to be known as the Beast of Bataan, the commander of the Japanese forces who invaded their homeland, the general whose orders led directly to the deaths of their friends and compatriots. But their encounter was civil. The general asked them questions, and the soldiers answered very frankly. They told him that they did not trust Japan in its intentions toward the Philippines, and that the Japanese soldiers were barbarous and cruel. Homma did not reply. Before they sat down to dinner, Mariano Villarin decided to have a little fun with the general. He knew a couple of magic tricks, and so, holding up a thimble, he made it disappear from his hand, reappear inside the ear of a fellow constable, and then for the finale, teleported it inside the pocket of General Masaharu Homma. The Beast of Bataan could only gape in astonishment as he fished around inside his pocket to find the thimble inside. By late 1944, the Japanese gave up on their efforts to re-educate the Consta boys and flew many of them back to the Philippines. By that time, the Americans were regularly bombing Manila, gearing up for their big push to recapture the Philippines. Villarin and the Duke ended up passing the information they had gathered in Tokyo to American forces. Meanwhile, the scholars who had stayed behind, including the rebellious Benjo Osias, became clerks, guides, and translators for the US military when they occupied Japan. As for General Masaharu Homma, the Beast of Bataan was brought back to Manila after the Japanese surrender and stood trial as a war criminal. He was convicted for his role in the abuses of prisoners of war during the Death March. In April 1946, Masaharu Homma met his end in front of a firing squad. The old samurai, bullets piercing his body, breathing out one last choked breath in the homeland of his enemies. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Colonial Department. References used in this episode are written on the show notes, but I'd also like to express my thanks to my main sources. The story of the Consta Boys comes from Mariano Villarin's 1990 memoir, We Remember Bataan and Corregidor. Meanwhile, two essays by Takamichi Serizawa and Jason G. Carlin provided the background on Shunro Ishikawa's novels and Japanese-Philippine relations. Finally, the University of the Philippines Press, Kwentong Bayan Nung Panahon ng Hapon, gave more details about everyday life under Japanese rule. Quotes from sources were read by Anya Ong. Audio snippets were taken from NHK, archival Japanese newsreels, and The Last Samurai from Warner Brothers Pictures. The Colonial Department was written and produced by Leo Mangubat. Follow us on Instagram at The Colonial Department.